House Water and Environment.
Mr. Chair.
Congressman Cruz.
Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2181.
Congressman Cruz moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2181. And we'll have a little like explanation on this, right? So let's have the Legislative Council up to explain why we'll be doing this.
Suspending the rules.
Let's suspend the rules first, okay?
Yeah.
Any objection? Hearing none, so passed.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cruz.
I move we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2181 was sent to Revenue Committee with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Cruz moves that we reconsider the vote by which we passed House Bill 2181 and it was sent to the floor with a due pass
revenue.
Recommendation. To revenue, excuse me. Do we have any objections? Hearing none, so moved.
Okay, now do you want to?
Yeah, okay. We'll get Mr. Dexter up. Dexter Johnson. Yeah, Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, members, good afternoon. I'm Dexter Johnson with the council office, and I am here to answer any questions you have about House Bill 2181.
Currently, Dexter, we had a...
Go through this in your packet. We adopted at the last meeting the Dash 1 amendment with two conceptual amendments to the Dash 1 amendment, which I since found out from Dexter that we weren't able to do. The concept amendments were to delete Section 4 and to add an emergency clause. And the portion we can't do as a committee is adopt an emergency clause, which Mr. Johnson can talk about, and also DC has some opinions regarding Section 4 and why that language was there to begin with.
Yes, Mr. Chair, in Article 9, Section 1A of the Constitution, it prohibits bills relating to taxation or exemption from carrying an emergency clause. And the reason for this is to ensure that the public has a right to refer those kinds of bills to the voters by collecting a proper number of signatures. The courts have interpreted that term, bills relating to taxation or exemption, very broadly and would include something like the Dash 1 amendments, which is in essence an expansion of the pollution control tax credit to non-point source pollution control facilities. And therefore, an emergency clause would not be allowed.
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
so that is the only thing you have a problem with. What you did, the elimination of Dash 4, we certainly could do conceptually. Do you have an opinion on why Dash 4 needs to be...
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, Section 4, it is not required to be in the bill, but generally it's often advisable in tax bills to have an applicability provision where you state when changes in tax laws, what tax years they apply to, or in this case, where there's a certification process, what certifications the changes apply to. That avoids confusion over whether the changes are, in fact, retroactive. You must all remember that income taxes, they're reported on returns that can be amended for up to 3 years after the date they're filed, and they're filed after the year for which the income was earned, or the events took place that allow you to claim credit. And so it's often, in order to make sure that you are not unintentionally doing something retroactive, it's advisable to put in a applicability provision. If you want to do something retroactive, that can also be done simply by changing the date. But by having some type of applicability provision, you're making it clear what the scope of the changes in the bill.
Any questions? Okay. So we are
I guess then should I make this next motion now?
No, sorry,
but we
can
inadvertently
leave that in.
No.
Oh, we need to move
it. We need to actually delete it technically and adopted in emergency.
So I guess I need to make a motion on the phone number.
Yeah, we need to.
Yeah, we need on your spreadsheet to make a motion that the just and the rules of the have to make a motion to reconsider the motion by which we adopted the conceptual amendment.
Right. Mr. Chair?
Yes, thank you.
I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote by which House Bill 2181 was conceptually amended by deleting Section 4 of the Dash 1 amendments and adding an emergency clause.
That's been approved. Move will be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote by which House Bill 2181 was conceptually amended. Do we have any discussion? Hearing none, so move. Okay. Now we're next. Okay, and for the committee, for clarification, House Bill 2181 is now before us as if the conceptual amendments were never adopted. Okay? The Dash 1 amendments are still intact. It is now in order to entertain a motion to adopt different amendments or to move House Bill 2181 as amended to the floor with the due passing of two revenues, excuse me, to the floor. Two revenues still. No more food around.
I think we remove Section 4.
What we did was with Section 4, we had put in the emergency clause. Do we need Section 4 at all?
Mr. Chair, it is not needed, but it is often advisable just to make sure you're not changing something retroactive. If you wish to make a retroactive change, then you can.
But as far as that, you see, it'll be okay if we leave it in there.
Mr. Chair, it's okay if you leave it in, and although ambiguous,
mm-hmm.
legal is law if you take it out.
So we can have a motion. Mr. Chairman, given the success of the referrals raised in name, perhaps I suggest that we leave it with the Dash 1 amendment, and then if others of us and members of the committee want to approach the Revenue Committee on getting a potentially earlier effective date, we can do that in the Revenue Committee.
Mr. Chair,
that's
correct. I move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2181.
That's been approved. Move Dash 1 amendments to
the motion.
Oh, they're already adopted.
They are adopted.
Okay.
To move to the
with recommendation to revenue.
Okay.
To revenue.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2181 as amended to the Committee on Revenue with a due pass recommendation.
That's been approved. Move House Bill 2181 as amended to revenue with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Hearing none, will the clerk please call the roll?
Aye.
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 Aye. Morgan?
Aye.
Taylor?
Aye.
Chair Welch?
Aye. Having the required number of votes, House Bill 2181 as amended passes to revenue of a due pass recommendation. Thank you, Dr. We have several House bills before us here that we need to consider for movement to the floor or to appropriate committee. I will open work session in House Bill 3486.
I have some testimony from the agency of GLCD. They were not, I don't know whether time precluded, I can't remember their testimony, but I thought that we should probably include it in the record because it does raise some concerns.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
I thank the court.
Since we are putting things into the record, I have a letter from Thousand Friends of Oregon that they didn't have to testify. I'd like to add this also.
Okay. And what we can do is have, if they had copies for us, we can have them say a few words and present it with their... Would, let's see, let's bring up Thousand Friends first.
Good afternoon, Chair Welch, members of the committee. My name is Claire Batson. I'm representing 1,000 Friends of Oregon. I appreciate the opportunity to get something to the record. 1,000 Friends opposes 3486. You have the written testimony there before us. We see it as a rather draconian bill in that it authorizes different regions that are set forth in the bill to completely avoid LCDC regulation of land division and houses and farmland simply by getting together and developing an alternative plan. We think that is poor policy. LCDC was created over 25 years ago because counties were not really doing an adequate job of protecting their agricultural land base for production agriculture. And it's been shown that having a state agency implementing mandatory farmland protection policies is the most effective way to maintain agricultural land base. This bill would allow counties to avoid that, and we think it's the policy. So thank you for the opportunity to testify, and we urge you to reject this bill.
Thank you, Blair. Questions for both?
I'm not clear on when we had our last hearing on the 9th. If you have had a chance, Winston, to see the -2 amendment.
If I understand, the -2 are the ones that, rather than having any county can get together, that they're set regions set forth in the county. I'm assuming those are the ones. I did see those. The bill does not change our position.
Other questions? Okay.
Thank you.
Who else wanted to give testimony on this?
I think Ron Eber.
Was Ron.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ron Eber for the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I'll summarize what's on the statement that's coming around to you. We have reviewed 3486 as introduced. We've seen the -1 and the -2 amendments, and I believe there are even some conceptual amendments that are coming forward. We have a serious concern with this bill and the concept behind the bill, because since 1973, under Senate Bill 100, it was the Land Conservation and Development Commission that was establishing the standards for the protection of agricultural and forest lands. These are two of the most important industries, and the state has a long-standing policy to protect the land base for those two industries. The bill allows regions or groups of counties to develop alternative standards. I think under the dash for the conceptual amendments, the goals still remain as the standard, but there is no oversight or review by the commission. And so that would leave the adequacy of those alternative standards totally to the counties involved. Our experience with the review of county plans between 1975 and 1985 for compliance with the statewide goals showed that state review was necessary to protect the agricultural and forest lands in question. For example, prior to LCDC review in the Willamette Valley, those counties zoned an additional 300,000 acres of farm and forest lands for rural residential uses. That was based on their reading of what was adequate to meet the standards. When we reviewed it, we found a great many acres that were in agricultural and forest use and had to require those to be rezoned. In addition, even the lands that were included in farm and forest zones under the goal and some of the specific provisions that are found in Chapter 215, those zones allowed innumerable non-farm uses and land divisions that were clearly not allowed either by Goal 4 or Chapter 215. In our view, this bill alters the fundamental checks and balances in Oregon's land use planning program and eliminates the shared state and local responsibilities established under Senate Bill 100 for the protection of agricultural and forest land. It will lead to a great deal of additional rezonings and plannings and development in farm and forest zones to the detriment of the ag and forest industries. With that, I'll answer any questions that you would have.
Questions from the committee? No questions? Okay. Representative Lundquist, did you want to give some testimony on this and see what was in your mind was left?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's some conceptual amendments that are coming around that I'll speak about in a minute.
Okay.
Before we look at that, I just want to give, I guess, a little bit of background. We've had some discussion before about this. The whole concept here is the idea that a reasonable approach to land use planning, and this is a very narrow, if you follow the statute amendments, it's a very narrow area. It only can deal with Goal 3, and that's what the conceptual amendments deal with. The regional approach is based on the philosophy that decisions made on a regional basis will be more in tune with the requirements to keep ag and a viable industry in that area. They'll look at all of the different alternatives that are there, and simply, my premise is, the closer to the source when we make decisions, the better decisions we make. And I specifically stayed away from the counties, doing it county by county, because I know that the difficulty of people concerned with the fact that maybe there's a good old boys club in a particular county, and they would, railroad through some changes that would not be good for the state. Well, that's why, with the regional approach, we think we get away from that. I appreciate the chair and Representative Morgan being a member on this bill. I think it's a viable concept. I travel the state a lot, and I can tell you there's nothing that divides this state or divides communities more than land use. I absolutely believe that to be true. And so if there's some mechanism over time to fine-tune, not do away with Senate Bill 100, and I think that is I know that is not the intent of this legislation, more of those of you in the committee that have been with me on this, but it's simply to allow what I call a common-sense approach to regional planning that will benefit Oregon. Without going through, I think, all the details, or simply what we have here, we have a framework set up for counties, if they choose, and it's an option, it doesn't mean they're mandated. If two-thirds of the counties in a particular region choose, they can go forward with this process. Develop these requirements at the regional level, and the conceptual amendments you had before that wasn't the department asked to put that in, because they wanted to make sure that we were not violating the goals. I think that's been very critical, that the standards at the local level being developed by the region do not violate the state goal that's applicable to that. That's not the intent, so we spelled out specifically in the language, so that would not be a problem. The question is, are we undoing land use planning from the state? I don't believe so. I agree with some Hansen. It's a law that's been on the book for 20-some years. I think it's time. The governor has said it prior to the section. It's time to look at some ways of enhancing the land use system that we have, and certainly not attempt to undo it. Would you find different standards in different regions? If you didn't, there wouldn't be any use to do it, though. I believe there are necessities that would dictate that we do have standards that are different in different regions. I'll just give you one example. Soil number six, or classification six. That type of soil in the Columbia Basin is part of the ag base. We would not want to change that. It's part of the dry land farm, and it works very well in that area. Class 6 soil in Central Oregon, for example, does not have that. We don't have the rainfall. Mother Nature took care of whether that was part of the agricultural base, not by Senate Bill 100 or anything else, but Mother Nature took care of that. And so we just simply don't have enough rainfall to do any dry land farming in the region that I'm talking about. That's just one example, Mr. Chair, of why I think the viability of the fact that we left this on a regional basis. And with that, I'll answer any questions, so I know you're on.
Questions from the committee?
By time.
Could you explain what a resource dwelling is?
Resource dwelling could be Mr. Chair or Representative Merkley. Resource dwelling would be a home on a farm. It's connected to the resource. It's not a non-farm home. It's not a non-farm dwelling. It's a building associated with the resource itself.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you, Representative Lundquist. And let's go ahead with the -3 amendments. Are they going to be done? That would be -3 to the change to the -2 coming and would give us the -3s, right?
Yes, Mr. Chair, you're correct. That would be the -3. They are not finalized. It would have to be conceptual or wait until the -3s are printed, and I'm not. Staff says that they're working on it right now.
Let me know when they're ready.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay. Anyone else want to give testimony on that? House Bill 3486.
Sean Gordon. I volunteer with Friends of Polk County. And I'm just very concerned that we're taking a policy to death where you take a state policy, a state set of laws, and you break that up into enforcement by county organizations, right? I think the very reason that they want to do that is the very reason that's very good. I think that we've found in Polk County that any reasonable thing that a county wants, they can usually talk through that with LCDC and the LCD and come to some sort of agreement. Without the LCD, we would have a lot more 5-acre parcels and a lot more 20-acre parcels in Polk County. And those are large enough that you can't mow the lawns on that kind of area, but they're too small to farm. And it's really important that we keep that kind of check and balance in our system. Thank you.
Thanks, Sean. Any questions? Thank you very much. Okay, I'll close it. Working
center? I'd like to make a couple comments on this. I applaud the direction this bill is attempting to go. I have some significant problems with it. One of those problems being it's to a large degree creating another level of bureaucracy, which is something I'm really not thrilled with. Number two, the divisions that are set up, if they're trying to get like land use in the same region to put Tooth and Curry County in with Jackson doesn't work. They are incredibly different. And another one that I have a real problem with is the Columbia, Upper Willamette Valley region, which consists of Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington counties, which in other terms is known as TriMet. And that's trying to do land use in its own version, in its own vision currently, and this, I think, is just furthering a practice in that part of the state that I find objectionable in the first place. So I have some real problems with the way this is currently structured.
Thank you. Any other comments? Close the work session. House Bill 3486. Let's go to opening work session, House Bill 3616. Yeah, I think we had all the work done on this. We're ready for okay, I'd like to have explanation of dash on a minute.
I have two.
All right. Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Dave Barrows, representing Chemical Waste Management, the owner and operator of the Hazardous Waste Disposal Facility at Arlington. The Dash 2 amendments represent, Mr. Chairman, represent what we discussed with the committee at the public hearing. What the Dash 2 amendments do basically are clean up some language that needed some adjustments, and the reason, again, for the committee's recollection, the reason this bill is so late in the process and such a high number is that it was our desire to try to work out all the details, because this is very specific kinds of boring law, with the Department of Environmental Quality, and we have done so. I believe Ms. Onan is here and could say again that Representative Cruz the last time asked Mr. Danko to speak on the record in support of the bill and of the amendments, and he did so. Associated Oregon Industries is also in support of the bill as amended by the Dash 2s, and to my knowledge, there is no opposition. No one testified in opposition, and no one has indicated to me they had any concern.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Okay.
Thank you, sir.
And there's Lori Arnon from DEQ here.
That's yours.
Sorry, did you want to comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Lori Arnon, Department of Environmental Quality. Mr. Barrows is correct that DEQ has worked closely and does support the bill and amendment.
Thank you very much. Anyone else want to give a comment? All right.
Sir, I move the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3616.
Representative Cruz moves Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3616. Any further discussion? Hearing none. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Cruz?
Aye.
Representative Atkinson?
I move House Bill 3616 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cruz moves House Bill 3616 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Hearing none, will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Cruz?
Aye.
Representative Atkinson? Representative
Sedlin? Aye. Excuse me.
Representative
Gianella?
Aye. Representative
Aye. Pending the required number of votes, House Bill 3616 as amended passed the floor to be passed recommendation. Who would like to carry this? Representative Devlin will carry. We close the hearing on House Bill 3616, work session on House Bill 3616. Session of House Bill 2885. Looks like we've got dash two amendments. We had the dash ones, and they weren't doing exactly what we wanted done here. And this was as you can see by the line two, line one and two, this is a Dutton set. We go to page 2 of the dash 2, and we have eliminated sub C, sub 1, and sub 2 of current law. And we need to do what that does. What this will allow us to do then, I don't think there's anything else. That was included. That was it. It should be. It let's see. Dave Honeycutt here. I want to explain real quick the dash two to 2885 as we have put in there, and are they doing exactly what we wanted them to do? We have a larger parcel. 80 acres or greater or less, and we want to segment out of that parcel forest land. When you use the property, forest land manager would have a larger acreage, and there would be a house and buildings, of course, with that, and they would section that out to 5 acres or 3 to 5 acres or whatever is necessary. And sell that, but maintain all the rest of in our forest land management. That's what we're trying to do the first time, but we didn't have the right amendments, correct?
Chair Welch, members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, yes, I believe that is correct. But what we tried to do with the dash two amendments is simply make it possible for the creation of the 5-acre lot, which the folks who no longer could manage the timber operation could live on, which is the current law, as I understand it, while at the same time making the remaining lot, not imposing the minimum lot requirements on the remaining parcel.
Right.
So that if you had a lot that was below the minimum parcel size already, or was right at the minimum parcel size, you could carve off the 5 acres, as I understand current law allows, and have a substandard parcel resulting from that, but that you could still have that substandard parcel, which essentially we're taking out the language that says the remaining parcel has to meet the minimum parcel size. And that was based upon a letter that I received from some folks down in, from a timber company down in Eugene area, who said that they, as far as they were concerned, they could still manage the remaining a parcel of that was smaller than the minimum lot size.
I had received several requests, and some not even in letter form, for the ability to do that from people managing larger tracts and not wanting to be landlords also was over a residential structure. So that's a good ability to do that. Can I bring the department up if they would like to comment on this? Bob?
Mr. Chair, I think the Department of Forestry would be first to comment. Let me remind you, my own memory is that in 1985, we put this language in, and the reason was that the timber industry approached us and indicated that, in general, they like to manage parcels that are based on the minimum lot size, which are 40s and 80s. And occasionally, in order to acquire such a parcel, there's already a dwelling on the parcel. So they would like to be able to cut that dwelling off and not manage the dwelling, and then manage the remaining parcel. We agreed to do that, and this legislation was passed, and what you see in the statute now codifies that. We weren't interested in authorizing folks who have, say, a 10-acre parcel or even a 6-acre parcel to cut it into two parcels, leave the dwelling on one, and leave the remaining parcel, small parcels in timber areas. And I'm afraid that just pulling this language out would have that effect. It isn't going to result in large 40s and 80-acre parcels that are managed as forest land, because there's nothing in here that keeps a person who has a 6-acre parcel cutting it into two pieces, 1 5-acre for the dwelling and additional parcel. I think that's the effect in...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kevin Birch from the Department of Forestry. I can only echo Bob's sentiment. In 95, we worked on this bill, and it was a compromise bill. And when we talked to industry, they were most concerned about removing the dwelling and then having a larger parcel that was more manageable. Timber companies like to be blocked up into larger acreages and are not normally as interested in small substandard parcels. There's a concern that if we have a lot of substandard small parcels, that we would fuel desire for residential development in the area. That's been our experience, and that's something that we were hoping to avoid. With that, I can answer.
Well, as I understand, this doesn't occur a lot. It's just occasionally when there's, you know, the large lot acreages of forest land bought, and there's a house on it, and it occurs occasionally. It's not that you're going to end up with a lot of, you know, as per your words, substandard lots out here. I mean, they're there already, and people are living in them. They're just attached to larger acreages. The forest land is going to be managed as forest land, ESU. And the houses don't have to be torn down.
Members of the committee. That's the way that the current law is. You have to leave a large parcel. This provision would extend it to small parcels, to where if you had a 10 or a 6-acre parcel or a 15-acre parcel, you could break the 5 and make another small parcel out of it. The reason that this is not used a lot is because you have to leave a standard size parcel rather than a substandard parcel. It's our sense and our concern, I guess, that we would be using this a lot more than we currently are now, and that it would be used for non-timber purposes as well as timber management purposes, and that we would end up with a residential use in the forest land, a pure residential use on that 5-acre parcel, and then a substandard parcel that may or may not be attractive or in a lot of cases, would not be attractive for legitimate timber management.
Chair Wells, I just want to remind the committee, I don't think these amendments allow for the creation, as a matter of fact, they don't allow for the creation of any new dwellings. They simply say for the dwellings that are existing out there now, that they can be
that the 5-acre parcel can be created regardless of whether or not the remaining parcel meets the minimum lot size fence.
Well, knowing some of these companies and their intent here would be to allow the house to remain standing and what other buildings there were worth with it, but the company is going to want as much of that property in forest land management as possible. So they're going to cut this down to a minimum parcel, and then as you read in sub C, the remaining parcel not containing the dwelling is not entitled to a dwelling unless subsequently authorized by law or goal.
That's correct, Your Welsh, and I think it might also make it easier or viable for the remaining portion of the parcel that's cut off to be maintained properly for timber production. And if you have to own the entire parcel but you no longer wish to manage the operations on the parcel, then you won't effectively be managing the parcel for timber production. Whereas if you could, a company could come in and manage that parcel and carve off your 5 acres so you wouldn't have to move, or just continue, or just live there and let the rest go, you know, go on and become unproductive, then you have I think that's sort of a win-win for everybody.
Mr. Chair, I think the concept works as long as the remaining parcel is large enough to manage for timber. And the concern would be there are already a large number of substandard parcels in the timberland in the state. And many of those are 10s or 20s. You know, they're small parcels with a dwelling on them. And when you divide, you're simply doubling the number of those substandard parcels, because this will now allow you to divide all of those in half. For a large number of those, that remaining parcel is not very viable or even desirable for a timber company to manage for timber use, especially if the remaining parcel is, say, a 5 or a 10-acre piece. The reason we agreed to this compromise in 85 is the current statute leaves that remaining parcel as a 40 or an 80, which we think is what timber companies testify to. They like to trade those, manage those. Those are the size they generally seek. I think really the way to look at this amendment is it's just a question of, right now we have something that keeps the remaining parcel as a large parcel. We eliminate all standards of size such that remaining parcel could be all the way down to 1 acre and really expect those remaining parcels to be managed for timber.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if I may, the same argument that you've heard today is one that we heard when we discussed the bill in 95. And the sense was that if we created a lot of substandard parcels, that someone would come back to you and say, you know, this parcel really isn't manageable for timber, and let's change the law, just as we're doing now to change it to allow substandard parcels, let's change the law and allow a residential use on these parcels. Deed restrictions only go so far. If you fuel the demand for residential uses in forest zones over time, it's been our experience that you end up with those kinds of residential uses, that someone will be back to you the next time after this compromise, asking to change this compromise, as we're asking to change the compromise that was made in 95.
Yeah, but as I read this, we're talking about ORS 215.78, and we're talking about the land zone for exclusive farm use and not designated range land, at least 80 acres, and forest land. At least 80 acres here, 168. You know, 80 acres and above. We're not talking about anything smaller, are we?
Yes, we are, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. That's what this bill would do. Would extend the provisions now that have 80-acre parcels or 40-acre parcels, depending on the zoning, to be able to divide a 5-acre parcel off of a 10-acre parcel or a 6-acre parcel or a 20-acre parcel and end up with two substandard parcels, one with a dwelling and one a small substandard parcel that may or may not be attractive for forest management. It's been our experience that the larger parcels, the 80s especially, are actively traded, but you get into the smaller parcels and it's not actively traded, I'm unfortunate.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
That's confusion over here. The on page 2, line 27, it large letter D shall not result in a parcel of less than 35 acres except where the purpose of the land division is to facilitate an exchange of land involving a government agency, or where the purpose of the land division is to allow transactions in which at least one participant is a person with a cumulative ownership of at least 2,000 acres of forest land. So it's the only reason that you're creating less than 35-acre parcels is to facilitate a public lands exchange, or to put it in the ownership of a large timberland owner. I guess I'm kind of wondering what the problem is. Am I reading this wrong?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, yes, you are reading it wrong. That provision is only for farm forest zones and mixed farm forest zones, which we have a few that have smaller than 40-acre minimum lot sizes. This provision as written would go into the general forest areas that have 80-acre minimum lot sizes and allow you to create any size parcels. The piece that you're reading only goes along with farm forest zone, which was a special agreement done for those specific zones where we tend to have more residential uses and smaller than 48 or 88 units.
May I clarify this here? So I'm still attempting to understand what you told me. The division less than 35 acres only applies to farm forest and not to forest. Is that what you said?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, yes. If you'll read sub C, little c, okay, then A, B, and C below that apply to sub C. Sub C says for mixed farm forest zones. And these provisions that require a 40-acre or subsequently 35-acre parcel are only for the farm forest, mixed farm forest zone.
I see what you're saying.
In the regular zones, which the paragraph D in the current law C to be changed above applies to all forest zones.
Any questions? I guess you should have some confusion. You're talking about it splitting off a home site on a 10-acre parcel, which you say obviously is not economically viable at that point in time. It's not economically viable either way. So, 10 acres of trees, you can't live very many years on that. So maybe 9 months. The misunderstanding of learning, I guess. But still, the point is, these sub-sized lots are not economically viable as they are, so splitting off the house doesn't make them less economically viable. I'm not sure.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, most of the dwellings that you find out there were put out there under what is called the necessary and accessory test, where a landowner came in and said, we need this house to manage this lot, whether it's a 20 or 40. In the current laws that were worked out in 93, we tried very hard to identify areas where small woodland owners had an opportunity to manage the property in conjunction with a dwelling. And if you talk with small woodland owners, you'll find that there is a demand for that kind of use. And in 93, the legislature wanted to provide some of that use in some places where there was already some kind of conflict, but not extend that kind of use everywhere into the forest. And they came up with what was called a template test, and the template test allows you to get a dwelling in areas that already have some level of parcelization and conflict, and it provides an opportunity for small woodland owners to manage on a part-time basis that forest land in conjunction with a house. And those are the kinds of parcels that this law would end up applying to, would be those small parcels in areas that already have a number of parcels and a number of houses, instead of the way that it is now, only applying out in portion of what you would consider the industrial, if you will, more industrial forest land, where we're going to have large parcels above the 80-acre lot size, and we can carve an 80-acre off of that parcel and with a 5 and 80 or larger off of that parcel. This then would take it into that. This law would change things so that in those areas that are currently providing for small woodland owners to have a part-time forest use and a part-time residential use, we would be making small substandard parcels in those areas. And that's what the effect of this bill would be. Which you should take that from the general forest, the large forest industrial owners, and then move it down to where we have this smaller use.
So you're worried about those acreages that are certainly under 80, and they carve off, say, 5 acres off of a 10 or something. But aren't most of those going to be acquired because they are adjacent to another larger parcel? Many times it'll be sold then and still be maintained as ESU and forest land, and probably because it's next to a larger parcel, there's industrial forest land. I don't understand why, you know.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, people own forest land for a large variety of reasons, and the smaller the parcel size, and there's a very good correlation. The larger the parcel size, the more they want to manage for timber. The smaller the parcel size, the less they're concerned about timber values and want to use the parcel for other values. As we break up and make things smaller and smaller and have more and more residential development to the area, we get less and less timber from the area and more other values from the area. And it's a balancing act.
I think we're reading a lot more into this than what was originally intended. President Morgan.
First of all, I'm not sure that we're going to be putting more and more houses in here. It seems that what this does is it provides it has a provision for somewhere between 5 and 10 acres, depending on the situation, with a house on it to be broken off. And then depending whether you're looking at farm forest or whether you're looking at forest land, it defines the minimum lot sizes and states real clearly that the remaining parcel won't ever have a house on it.
So I don't get the part about how we're setting up to have more houses here.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, if I may, it has been our experience that as you create more substandard parcels, that those parcels get used for non-timber values, that people buy them with expectations, and that over time, that you will have someone come to you next session and say, you know, really, we ought to be able to build on these parcels because they're substandard. It's just like in 95, we heard that we don't want to extend this law to areas that have smaller than standard parcels. You will hear the next session or the session after that we want to get houses on it. It just fuels the demand. And as you break the ownership up into smaller and smaller pieces, regardless, you get less and less management for timber on those particular parts.
So may I have a follow-up?
Yes.
You don't think that it is a significant level of safety that there's whole section in here that deals with putting restrictions on to make sure that there's no dwelling on the remaining parcel?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, I believe that someone will come back to you in the future and say, let's remove that provision. Just as you're hearing now, let's remove the provision that we must have a large parcel, that this is only going to be associated with large forest industry type parcels. We're asking to change that now. The next thing that you'll hear is let's change and let's allow dwellings on the parcel. That's just a prediction. I didn't know to be wrong in the past.
You have
That would be my guess.
Well, as I suspected, we are reading into it here. But the company that was asked for this, they said in their letter here that, as you might suspect, we bought the parcel for its timber value, not its residential value.
and we're not in the residential real estate or rental business. And we neither have the time or expertise to deal with rentals. Also, tearing the house down is not a wise option. And we can go into that, but we won't. Because housing is pretty expensive in Oregon today, and we're looking for options to reduce that. And tearing down more houses won't help us any. And first, even though we bought the land for the timber value, we were still forced to pay some premium for the home. Second, it is poor community relations for a timber company to come into a community, buy property, and immediately proceed to kick the renters out and bulldoze the home down. We have what we... Well, on one hand, DLCD, Thousand Friends, Spartan Forestry, and a whole bunch of others want. We have companies out there that are buying smaller pieces and building more property. And I have them work for one to get that. And putting those into contiguous form wherever you can, and to build larger blocks of resource land that we appreciate on one hand. On the other hand, we run into situations like this, it would be very helpful if we could have a little bit of flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
So we're kind of doing battle here, and I think we're getting a little sideways in this, and reading into it we're not trying to build more houses out there. We're not trying to tear down the ones that are
fair. Well, the other instance where I think this bill is important is for the folks who are no longer able to manage a large parcel, but they don't want to move. Rather than, if it's an 80-acre parcel, rather than taking 80 acres out of production where there's no management activity, would we not be better off to allow those folks to retain their house on the small parcel and then transfer the remainder parcel to a timber company that can actively manage it? I think that's probably a wiser alternative.
Sure. I think it's very likely that there are a number of timber companies who would do as you're indicating, as the proponents here are asking. And I think what we're saying is we're not disagreeing that timber companies would like to get rid of the house and then manage the rest of it. I think, though, the way this has been worded, is it's going to be much more often used by folks who have smaller parcels, of which there are a large number, who acquired a dwelling on, say, a 10 or a 20-acre parcel many years ago and would be very happy to divide that off and sell the 5s to sell the 10. You see a lot of 5s and 10s created in the floor plans. Yes, today you can't build on those, but as there are more and more of those, I think the pressure on you to authorize dwellings on those, especially if people buy those and perhaps find out later that they can't build, it's going to be a lot of things down the road.
If I may, just one more. In 1995, for exactly the reasons that you're articulating, is why we worked on this bill, and we agree that those are very valid reasons, and that a lot of forest landowners do not want to manage dwellings. We also did not want to extend this carte blanche throughout the forest. And when we talked with and we heard or had discussions with OFIC and the other forest landowners about this, they indicated that they were most interested in those larger standard parcels rather than substandard parcels. And it was a compromise at the time, a feeling that this rule, this law, would be used most often for the reasons that you're articulating if those parcels were larger and were standard sized, and that we would avoid some of the conflict, the reduction in opportunities for small woodland owners with a dwelling to manage, and also reduce the conflict that we would have having a lot of non-timber value out in the forest land if we separated out, or if the bill separated out into standard sized parcels and substandardized parcels and only allowed this traditional standard parcels. That was the reasoning at the time and why this ended up with written the way that it was in there.
Okay. Any other questions, comments? I appreciate it. Okay, though. Proposed work session on House Bill 2885. It's amazing. Work session on House Bill 3028. Let me just have a hearing on that. Any hearing on that?
That's too new.
I think we just have to have this one of those ones. Yeah, we had a dash one and a dash two. Okay. Don, would you like to tell Mr. Schellenberg come up and talk about the dash one and two here? Yeah, we got them.
Mr. Chairman, Don Schellenberg, representing the Oregon Farm Bureau. Dash 1 and dash 2s, we prefer the dash 2 because it causes less problems as far as misinterpretation. The dash 1s would add the word public in there, and the thought behind that possibility was that is there a difference between an individual concern regarding health and safety or between that and a public health and safety. And we thought it would just confuse things too much if we added the word public. And so the dash, all the dash twos do is simply delete the word welfare, which is what our initial concern was with the bill and the reason we introduced the bill. Since that's such a broad general term, we just wanted to delete that word. So we do prefer and recommend the dash two.
Dash two takes care of it?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, Don. Questions from the committee?
Sure.
Yes, Ms.
Deleting the word welfare is problematic for me because I recall that our testimony the first time around that health, safety, and welfare are really the basis of the local zoning law. And welfare is a term that's used in several times in statute, according to the League of Oregon Cities testimony, I believe, that we have. And so I'm not supportive of deleting that from our statute.
Okay. Other questions? Okay. I've got those. I know where those come from. Close hearing on House Bill 3020, our work session 3028. And. And before we move on to Senate Bill, let's go to open a work session on 2866 and see if we have any further testimony. Anybody here wanting to talk about where we are on 2866? The surveyor's legislation.
Thank you.
President Wallace, is this possible 3866?
Yes, 3866.
Representative Wallace and other members of the body. I'm Bob Ezell, Lane County Surveyor. I've been Lane County Surveyor for 20 years. I've reviewed probably over 1,000 subdivision plans. The Lane County Legislative Committee and I and the Oregon Association of County Engineers and Surveyors are opposed to the sales bill. Last meeting on HB 2866 before this legislative body, Chair Welch directed the Professional Land Surveyors of Oregon and the Oregon Association of County Engineers and Surveyors to set up a meeting and get together and come back with points of agreement. And I want to inform you that that meeting never happened. The County Surveyors attempted to set up a meeting, but the other side did not pull up. So this is the first look at this House bill since that time. The proposal of changing the 45-day requirement, which is current law, leaves total discretion up to the private surveyor. I think with some wording that could be agreeable to me, but I have to say that it's not agreeable to all the county surveyors. So I wanted to give an example of the difficulty on the property owner when the county surveyor doesn't, or the private surveyor does not perform. I got a call from a landowner who wanted to add an addition to their house, and she couldn't get the private surveyor to return phone calls, could not make any contact with him. And so here she had a proposed amendment for her house, an addition to her house, and she had a contractor and all of the stuff that goes with an addition. I intervened for her and contacted the surveyor eventually and got things back on track. But imagine with the wording that they have, if it's just up to the discretion of the private surveyor, what avenue does this person, for example, have to turn to? Right now, a person has a violation of 45 days because of the order of the examiner. And so there is that threat right now. Last session, Representative Taylor, to paraphrase her statement, asked the question to the PLSO, Professional Engineers of Oregon contingent, is this proposed law good for the public or just making the plat requirements more convenient and efficient for the plat surveyor or the plat developer? And I contend that is the case for that. One of the proposals here is to revise the post-monumentation plat requirements. And now let me explain about post-monumentation. If a plat is going to be have all the monuments set on it, then they set all the monuments on the lot corners and angle points and the streets and center lines and so forth that are required by the statute. On a post-monumented plat, it's recognized that street construction and construction of sewer lines and utilities, so it makes no sense to agree to take and set those monuments on the interior of the plat because they'll be poured out and it's just tossing the money away. So they have a process called post-monumentation where it is allowed for the monuments on the interior of the plat to be set, provided that the plat surveyor or developer posted a deposit of money or a recognized bond. And then after the construction is done, when the plat is completed, the county surveyor is required by statute to check both kinds of plats, the post-monument plat as well as the regular plat. I might point out that since 1947, when they started the plat requirements, it required the county surveyor to review plats. In 1971, it was amended that the county surveyor actually go in the field and take field measurements and observations of the plat. So, what is being lost if they change the statute to just, for example, set angle points? If you could envision a large plat, for example, that might have a back lot, or a back side, 2,000 feet long, 1,000 feet long, if the surveyor only sets the angle points in that plat, the adjoining landowners, by not setting the lot corners, are not giving constructive notice that the plat, for example, might intrude into their property, that they consider to be their property, might intrude past their fence lines and things like that. So that's one of the things that's lost. The other thing is the difficulty of the county surveyor to take the field measurements as required by the statute if the lines aren't brushed out as they would be by the current statute.
Did you get a chance to look at the dash two?
That would be 19 or 5-5.
Yeah, 5599.
Yeah.
That's what you're working off of.
Yeah, as I understand, it would be all of that plus the current amendment that they have today. And I talked with their representative, and I understand the amendment. The other proposal, which is very objectionable to the Council of Errors, is a proposal to narrow the review of the class. And what it does is take away discretionary judgment of the Council of Errors. What they propose is valuable in its current law, which is when we review a plot, we review it for the survey requirements as required by Ordinance Law Statute 29250, which is the general boundary survey, which is required by the current law. The other is in Chapter 92, it has to do with just such things as they need to put lot numbers on the plot, they need to put street names on the plot, they need to name the plot. Those are valuable things. But the discretionary judgment that I talk about is, and although it's very rare to happen, I have had situations where I actually had parts of houses, for example, intruding into the plat were not shown on the plat until the field reviewed took and showed that. Or, for example, there are fences in the plat. The important thing about fences is there is a section of law which is called transfer of real property by unwritten means. And if, for example, a fence is 20 years old, for example, the residents that live there against that fence, there is a possibility that fence, even though it's not in their deed, can turn into a property ownership. And I'll give you an example. In the city of Springfield, a plot I was reviewing had minimum size lots. That is, their code says they only have a lot of 6,000 square feet, for example. In the review of the plot, it showed a fence. And so I inquired about, well, what about this fence? Well, it turned out it was an ancient fence. The adjoiner did not agree that they can give up their property as to the deed monumentation. This is not questioning that the boundary survey was not corrected by the surveyor. The issue is that the fence was considered to be by the property owner their line. In this case, it was the situation was an elderly lady, and the fence had been there a long time, and so I stopped the plat. So we need to take and resolve this issue. And it did stop the plat. And what came out of it was, in essence, a life estate or easement for that landowner to begin to use that area until they passed on. And then the land would revert back to the plat. It was an easy solution, but it was one where I'm talking about discretionary judgment of the strength of error, which would be removed by the statute. So those are the contentious issues that we still have before us that have not been resolved. We have not met as requested by the Sheriff Elk, and so we still are opposed to this increase in suspicion as opposed by the potential grants of the recording.
Thank you. Questions on the committee? Thank you very much. Mr. Forey, thank you very much for speak to this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Stephen Kafori. I'm here representing the Professional Land Surveyors of Oregon, which is an organization of both county surveyors and private surveyors, and also public surveyors who work for other agencies. So we have quite a mixture of licensed surveyors in our organization. You've heard a lot of very, very technical information on this bill, and I guess in some ways you don't really need to know all the details of the technical information, because what it really boils down to is who's been making judgment calls and where. We think that you've heard some problems have occurred when surveyors have brought their surveys in to be recorded. And in our view, if there are problems, those problems can be dealt with professional to professional. The kind of surveyor can say, here's something that you didn't see, or here's something I wish you would change. And those are often professional judgment calls. And we feel our folks are licensed. They're trained the same as the folks who are the county surveyors, and that if there's something the county surveyor is pointing out that makes sense, then we would be more than happy to go back and take a look. If there's an elderly lady who's got a fence problem, for example. We think the bottom line is that if there are problems with the quality of the survey, that the proper forum for that determination is the professional land surveyors. I can put the Osbiel's Oregon Board of Engineering and Land Surveying, and that that's where those decisions ought to be made. We think that the licensed surveyors can take a look at the circumstances on the ground and make those decisions themselves. And I want to say that we do have a number of county surveyors who are on the professional land surveyors working site. It's not just the private surveyors versus county surveyors issue. There are members of both factions on both sides of this issue. And I would hope that you would pass the amendments and you should pass the bill on. We did make a concession regarding the archivability, and I think that's one that we have been meeting in the halls, and we've been meeting with the county clerks. I think we're moving towards a resolution of that issue that we can do behind the scenes. And none of these others are really kind of, you come down to one side or the other, who's going to make the call? And we think that the professional land surveyors, as they're out there in the field, should be making the calls.
What happened? Why didn't we get a work set or work group together between the two?
Mr. Chair, we've been meeting with these folks for a number of years on a hard regular basis, and I don't think there's anything at this point to be gained by meeting with them again. We have, there's an organization called OASIS, which is the Oregon County Engineers and Surveyors, and they meet regularly. Our legislative committee has county surveyors on the committee, and we also have been meeting with those folks. It's like two different interest groups that you bring together and say, why don't you guys resolve your differences? We do a lot of communication together already. There's email. Every night I come back to my office in Portland, and there's 5 or 10 emails. These things have been talked about among the professionals.
Okay. Questions?
Just clarification. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the part about the media has been resolved with the county clerk and no longer needed in this measure?
Mr. Chair, Representative Taylor, it's not been totally resolved. We're working very close to a resolution on that.
So to clarify further, yes. Mr. Chair, thank you. So what we're left with then is the witness monument and the role of the county surveyor, which would be limited under the measure to his review, his or her review. Is that the two pieces that were...
Mr. Chair, President Taylor, there's one more issue, and that has to do with the 45 days. If the surveyor is not able to complete the work within 45 days, which is not uncommon. Right now, there's no statutory authority for the county surveyor to say, well, I understand you've got a problem. Why don't you bring it back to me in another month or 2 months? That's happening now informally, and we think there ought to be a provision for that in the statute so that we can come back. And that's a minor point of contention, not a major one, but it is a point that we disagree with.
President Devlin?
Thanks, Chairman. It may sound like an unusual question, but I'm having a hard time figuring out where the opposition and where the support is centered on this bill, because in Douglas County, I have letters from the county surveyor, and I have letters from private surveyors, all saying they're supportive of the bill. Then in Clackamas, Yamhill, Marion County, I have county surveyors saying they're opposed to the bill, and I've gotten calls from private surveyors saying that they're opposed to the bill also. Now, if there was a problem in Douglas County with the county surveyor, then I could see the private surveyors wanting it if they had a problem with the county surveyor. The county surveyor there is in support of the bill. So I'm trying to figure out what the dynamics of this are, and there doesn't seem to be any rational reason for why each side is either in favor or opposed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, you've asked a very interesting question. And I've only represented these folks for about 6 or 8 years. I don't know totally what it is either. I think, to be perfectly straight with you, there have been, in some counties with specific county surveyors, some terrible problems. The preceding county surveyor to Clackamas County, not the one that's there now, had such enormous problem that the the county commission was really trying to get rid of them, but it was an elected county surveyor, and they had no authority over it. There have been specific times, specific places where there have been very, very severe problems. The other thing is that surveyors work around the state. They don't just work in their own county. They work mostly in their own region. But you'll find that a surveyor who's from a big firm in Portland, for example, will work in 20 different counties and vice versa. So it's not just a regional or localized issue. And so you can't really break down, say, the southern Oregonians feel this way and the northern Oregonians feel that way. It doesn't fall into any categories.
Follow up.
Yes.
I'm not going to try to find the letter. But one of these letters makes reference to that the private surveyor is the group that you represent. That 40% of them, I believe, is what you're supposed to oppose this measure. Have you done any kind of survey where someone would have a basis for that number?
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, our groups try to operate on a consensus basis, and over the years, I can't tell you how many votes there have been, how much email correspondence there has been, how much discussion. I've visited all these chapters and talked about these issues, or listened to them talk about them. Most of them, when they start getting into the technical areas, they're frankly over my head on a lot of the details. But I instigated discussions about it and led discussions on it. Our decision-making board is the board of directors of PLSO, which, as I say, represents all the licensed surveyors in the state. And the board has agreed that they want, and has agreed with our legislative committee that they want this bill with even that.
Mr. Chairman, this time. So there's been no real, I'm not saying that's a statement in support or a statement in opposition, but when someone tries to make a claim that 40% of your membership opposed to this, nobody's conducted such a survey.
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, I've seen an attempt at it. I don't think the attempt that was made is very accurate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I have I know that in some counties the surveyor is elected and others with an appointee position, and I never felt qualified as a voter to actually know who would serve as a surveyor. Way out of my experience level there. Do you see any correlation between the difficulty, whether that person is an elected or an appointed official? I know that sometimes also county surveyors are people who are doing private surveying work in addition to being a county surveyor. So it's gotten really confusing to me.
Mr. Representative Taylor, there is a bill in the legislature. I believe it was the Home Builder Association introduced it to eliminate elected surveyors and have them all be appointed. Our group is quite split on that and not split along any lines that make any sense on that one either. I think it's too easy to look back and say, I like my surveyor and he's elected, so he's got to be, that's got to be a good process. Or, I like my surveyor and he's appointed, so that's got to be a good process.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Corey. Mr. Corey. They wanted the dash one and two, right? On this, or did the two take the place of the one?
Mr. Chair, remember, the dash two take the place of the one.
Okay.
Right.
Representative Cruz.
I move the dash two amendment to House Bill 2866.
Representative Cruz moves the dash two amendment to House Bill 2866. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair, we did have testimony when we talked about this bill earlier that said they didn't care if it was 90 days into the 45 days. They just thought there should be some kind of limit. And the dash to establish that, so I wondered if there had been any, it's hard when they didn't meet and there was no further discussion.
I
What did we get? We got 45 days now.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Tim.
Mm-hmm. Man, I said there's a long time.
You see, Dave, I've talked to, I don't know how many, some of them talk. Neat of it. Interesting. Okay. Any other discussion? Any opposition?
Yes, sir. I think I'll oppose it.
Representative Taylor has opposition to the dash two. Okay. Every required number votes.
Sure. Number 2268 as amended the floor to do pass recommendation.
Okay, Cruz moves. House bill 2861 as amended. 2866 as amended to the floor to do pass recommendation. Any further discussion?
Sure, I'm sorry to have to oppose this bill, but I have had so many letters in opposition to it, and as the proponent of the bill has told us, it comes down to who makes the call, and I guess my preference would be that we leave the call with the elected or appointed public position.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, I will be voting no on the bill in committee. So I'm going to be conducting my own little survey in the meantime before it comes to the floor. And based on the results of the survey, I may be changing my vote to yes.
Thank you.
Sure.
Ms. Ingram.
Representative Devlin surveyed the reviewable by the county officials.
Chairman, I will share my survey with Representative Merkley.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
My primary concern with this legislation has been, well, two concerns really. The first is the possibility that platted lots could be sold without encroachments on the property being discovered and revealed. And I have a letter today trying to answer my concern, and the letter said in part, the owner of the new lot always has the ability to file a lawsuit, and I don't consider that the appropriate way to resolve whether a newly platted lot has the boundaries that you think it has when you buy it. I think the existing process of determining the exterior positions makes a whole lot of sense. My second concern is that the platted lots and surveys are going into the public record, and there's a very public purpose in having excellent clarity and accuracy in the public record, because small problems existing now have come back to haunt us 30 or 40 or 60 years from now as we are swimming hard in something like this committee over the road on the beach that is creating concern now. And I haven't been able to resolve that these two issues have been addressed adequately, and therefore feel for now it would be best to leave the law as it is and ask the groups to keep working on it.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I just passed a little note saying I wondered if it would be all right if I abstain. I don't think I understand this one well enough to vote on it. Thank you.
Okay. I prefer you just go with yes or no. I'm not sure we abstain.
Okay.
Just a yes or a no would be appropriate.
Okay, Chris. I'm in the enviable position of being in the county who's county surveyor, and all the professional surveyors in the county are in favor of the bill, so it's relatively simple for me. I happen to know our county surveyor rather well, and most of his life he was a professional surveyor, and he was elected basically because of frustration with the system, and he got in there and decided that there was a better way to do it, and that's why he supported the bill.
and I have represented the troops that have one county approved and one county, part of the county approved, and the other doesn't approve. Yeah, very difficult. Okay. Any other comments? Okay. Clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Cruz?
Aye.
Carrier, who would like to carry this? I don't think we can pass it. No, that would be a conflict. Who would like to carry this? Morgan.
I'll carry
it. Morgan will be the carrier.
You're doing a wonderful job, Lieutenant Morgan.
Yes, all right. We close the work session in the House Bill 3266, and we'll open the work session in the House Bill 3269. Pat Ethan. Where did he go? He was here.
There he is.
Yeah. Pat Egan and Peter and John Chandler, please come forward. House Bill 3269.
We already had this all figured out.
I think we'll have to admit in.
I can explain. Afternoon, Mr. Chair. For the record, Pat Egan with Beaverton and Hillsborough School District. The dash three that you have in front of you are basically the dash ones that we had offered with a couple of changes which encompass successful amendments that the committee wanted to provide greater specificity, including on line 8 of the dash 3, you've got the insertion of the word urban reserve, and then lines 10 and 11 by ORS 215-213-1A and 215-283-1A. Those are references to the siting of a school in the FU. And both of those, I think, just clarify the dash one amendments, which were primarily just an add-on to the original bill, just to make sure that the extension of city services outside of a UGB could be provided to a school being sited in an urban reserve. And that's it.
All right. Now, the dash threes are replacing the ones and twos?
Exactly. And
modifying them.
Well, I don't think the dash twos are not in there. The dash twos, that was another issue, not one that I'm familiar with. And I think the committee just didn't get into that. But they are a modification of the dash ones with the conceptual amendments that the committee wants.
Yeah, you're right. Dash twos, they didn't go there.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
That's it.
Very good. Any questions from the committee?
Yes, sir.
Oh, we've got some more chat on here.
Okay. Did I put anything?
Any other questions? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Randy?
Good afternoon, Chair Welch, members of the committee. My name is Mary Kyle McCurdy, representing 1,000 Friends of Oregon. Today, we're opposing House Bill 3259. This bill would allow the location of schools and urban services in urban reserves. Urban reserves are areas that are outside of urban growth boundaries, and currently Metro and Medford have designated urban reserves. This would essentially allow schools on farm areas because schools are allowed in many exception areas already. Schools are in urban use and should be located inside urban growth boundaries. Urban reserves are designated to set aside lands that might be eventually included in the urban growth boundary.
Urban reserves are lands that are beyond the 20-year land supply for the UGB. These lands may or may not ever come inside the urban growth boundary. Current law requires planning for urban services and schools in urban reserves, and that's appropriate, but we should not allow the location of urban facilities in these reserves, which may or may not come into the boundary. Schools are like freeway interchanges. They're magnets for development, as they should be. Communities should be built around schools. Better yet, schools should be located in existing communities where there is the existing demand for it. Don't allow schools to go on land in urban reserves because that land is cheaper. Land outside urban growth boundaries will always be less expensive than land inside urban growth boundaries. This bill is premature. We do not need the location of schools or urban facilities in urban reserves in lands that may or may not come into the urban growth boundaries 20 to 50 years from now. Thank you.
Questions? Any committee?
I have a question. I've heard from the opponents of the bill in the Beaverton area that there just isn't the land space and that's big enough available for the tank car. Big enough for a school to be sited.
Inside the existing urban growth boundary.
Right.
Chair Welsh, Representative Kapori. There is land in large enough chunks available inside the urban growth boundary for schools. A problem may be acquiring the land, purchasing it, but I don't think our land use system should be used to remedy an issue concerning funding of schools. And that's what this bill is doing. And again, locating a school outside an urban growth boundary will be a magnet for development, premature or maybe in an area that never would have come inside an urban growth boundary otherwise. Schools can be located in exception areas in at least two of the three metro counties, as I understand. This bill would open up farmland to the location of schools. So there are sites inside the urban growth boundary as well as on outside the boundary. This would attempt to open up farm and forest land to school sites.
Thank you.
We understand that work sites open, but they're not for the kind of prices that anything that saves the taxpayers some money.
Chair Welsh, I understand that. Again, I think we're using the land use system to solve a school financing problem.
Somebody suggested we just get rid of the urban reserves and the UGP, and we don't have space for that system, right? They won't go that way, but we do have to come up with some economical alternatives, and we're not getting very far in that direction. That's the devil.
Mr. Chairman, question. Can you give me the rough numbers for the metropolitan area in terms of how much has been refreshed on memory, designated urban reserves, how much has been brought in by the recent council's decision on legislative decision to amend the urban growth boundary, and how much of that is under appeal?
Chair Welsh, Representative Devlin, and I think Dan Cooper from Metro is still in the back. I need to have him verify these numbers. Metro has designated 18,600 acres as urban reserves. Of that amount, approximately 3,000 or so is exclusive farm use of forest use land. Metro has taken an initial step to amend its urban growth boundary into those urban reserve areas. And my recollection is that the boundary has been amended by somewhere around 3,000 acres. It has been expanded by somewhere in the neighborhood of 3,000 acres. And most of them are inside urban growth boundaries today. But all of the urban reserves are currently on appeal.
Thank you. Thank you. Other questions? Okay. I wanted to just make a quick announcement. House Bill 524, there's some more amendments, and I'm not going to have any hearing on that today. We'll wait or schedule it for Wednesday.
Bill 524.
We had a long hearing on it last week. Just let anybody who's come for that, but we will do that again on Wednesday. Hopefully we have the amendments, so we can take a look at those and discuss it further. Thank you. Okay, was there anybody else want to talk on House Bill 2259? Good gentleman. Carol Fell, please.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Philip Fell from the League of Oregon Cities, and we too are opposed to the language in House Bill 3259, even as amended. although I would note that the amendments begin to bring the bill a little bit more in line with existing land use plans. We're concerned that, if I may, that if we build it, they will come. We believe that if we extend urban services outside the urban growth boundary, people will want to tap into those services and will build a pretty credible case for doing that. There was an example several years ago down in Medford where we extended urban services to a farm labor camp that was directly on the urban growth boundary, just outside it. But we had to run a high-pressure water line, which is small, expensive, and impossible to tap into. That was the only way we could be sure that extending that facility would serve only that camp. The problem is that in these areas, eventually we assume that there will be some growth. So I would say that city taxpayers are not too excited about the idea of having to first run one kind of line and then come back and run a much larger line. I think it's a real inefficient approach to extending urban services. And again, I would point out that about four sessions ago, I think we adopted language which said school districts and cities need to sit down together and plan for the inclusion of schools within the urban growth boundary. So I agree with the previous witnesses that there is adequate space. It's a question of price and which citizens will pay which bill. Happy to answer questions.
Question. Thank you. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, is DLCD scheduled to speak on this?
Not scheduled, would you like to come forward?
Yes.
Okay. Would the department like to speak on this? Bob?
Mr. Chairman, my request is only to see if they're taking a position on the bill and the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bob Rindy with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. We did turn in testimony, I believe, on this, and we testified at your last hearing extensively on it. I think we testified then that we were not in favor of the amendments to extend services to the urban reserve, nor were we in favor of the proposal. We believe that the urban reserve are primarily if they are done according to rule, will primarily be made up of exception lands, and those exception areas do authorize school. So as we see, this bill is primarily to authorize farmland to develop school, and we are not in favor.
Thank you, Bob. Okay, we'll close work session at 3259. Let's open a hearing on Senate Bill 87. We have some people want to give some testimony here.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ray Thompson. I'm representing Metro, and with me is Dan Cooper, who's Metro's General Counsel. We're here to provide you with information regarding part of our process of planning on the urban growth boundary with respect to employment data. And Mr. Cooper has information that he'd like to give the committee to clarify the record, because I believe there was information provided last week that Metro does not estimate employment, which is just not true. And what we'd like to do is start the record and provide you with information or answer questions. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, my name is Dan Cooper. I'm Metro's General Counsel, and my address is 600 Northeast Grand, Portland, Oregon. This being passed out to you is a short letter signed by Mike Burton, our executive officer, and attached to it is a technical report and employment density study that we are currently involved in. And you can tell by the length of it that it's pretty technical and in great detail. I want to summarize Mr. Burton's letter. Job growth has been the foundation of all of Metro's forecasts for the last 20 years. We have a 20-year history of addressing the job land need in our region. We have estimated the job land need 5 times in this decade. We expanded the urban growth boundary for at least an estimated 6,300 jobs in 1998, and we are studying additional 1,800 acres, which we have indicated our intention to bring into the urban growth boundary. And if this land is brought into the urban growth boundary, it would provide an estimated another 7,700 jobs. We are upgrading our job analysis methods, and that's the attached report. And we have been working with the Port of Portland, CREEC, PDC, and other interested groups in our region in conducting the study. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you have. We are neutral on this bill. We have not taken any positions on it for or against it.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Questions? Representative Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's fortunate that Mr. Thompson has come here today and offered this testimony. But I think one thing that it points out is the previous testimony that the issue of job growth had not been taken into consideration. It clearly identifies that it was taken into consideration in both the study and the deliberation.
Correct. Other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. Okay, I think there's other work still going on that, so I'll just ask if somebody really want to give testimony. We'll open it up again later. We'll close hearing on Senate Bill 87. Looks like we have a few more people that would like to give testimony on Senate Bill 454. I think we still have work is ongoing on this one too, but I noticed there's a fairly good list. I'd like to get some testimony on it. So I don't know that. Then we haven't had a hearing. Okay, open a hearing on Senate Bill 454. Give me a chance to go get another piece. And we have someone traveling outside of 100 miles. Christina, would you give us a quick review?
Mr. Chairman, Member, Senate Bill 454 modifies the criteria for approval of farm dwellings in exclusive farm use zones. It makes the determination that a dwelling customarily provided in conjunction with farm use shall not be based in whole or in part upon an income test. Most of the change in the whole bill is on the first page, lines 21 through 24.
Okay, let's start with, looks like we got Rich Holcomb. Rich Forward. Mr. Taylor, would you take over on the sharing?
Sure.
I'll be back.
Chairman Welch and members of the committee. I'm Rich Holcomb. My brother and I operate a diversified farming operation in Northern Douglas County along the Umpqua River. And I graduated from Oregon State in the mid-70s and started out farming. My father has a farm there, but he's still actively farming, so it was became necessary for me to expand from there and acquire land in some form or another. And we began to lease, my brother and I began to lease property in the surrounding area, neighboring ranches, and over the course of time, we have put together a unit of where we own or are in the process of buying about 400 acres, 250 of which is timber ground. And we currently lease about 3,000 acres in addition to that. We run 600 mother cows, have several hundred yearling cattle, and 350 head of sheep. We help manage a small fruit orchard, and it keeps us fairly busy. Concerning the Senate Bill 454, it's been argued that this is a necessary bill to make it possible for young farmers to be able to acquire housing for when they're in the process of getting started. And I'd like to say that that simply is not the case. On the 3,000 acres we lease, we have 14 different parcels, 14 different ownerships. There's 17 houses on that on that amount of acreage, 10 of which are renter occupied, one of which my brother lives in, and 7 of them are owner occupied. So you see, there's no shortage of housing on farmland, and to my knowledge, that has never been the number one problem of young farmers getting started. The most difficult thing for new farmers starting out is building up working capital, and you don't do that by sinking $100,000 to $150,000 into a new home on a parcel that you are going to farm. If you don't inherit property, then you have to start out slow by leasing and then look at purchasing as you build the size of the operation. I think this bill will have an adverse effect on those who are just getting started in farming. It will, anytime you allow for more housing on farm land, it makes the value of that property increase, and it makes it more difficult for young farmers to acquire a sizable enough unit to be viable. And the other argument might be the bill is necessary to provide housing for hobby farmers or part-time farmers. And this opens up the issue of, do we want to conserve our best farmland for efficient economical production of farm commodities? And I feel that we need to wisely use this resource, and I find it ironic that the people proposing and supporting this bill that would increase development on farmland also were the ones that proposed the bill or have pushed for secondary land designation, which was argued that it would divert growth away from some of our high-value farmland. And to me, that's kind of an interesting contradiction. And the only way I can explain that is that I think that the driving force behind this sort of legislation has to be coming from those who are possibly in the category of hobby farmers, which there is a place for that, and also those involved in buying and selling real estate, and those who are in the building contractor business. And with few exceptions, this bill is not a good bill for future of agriculture in Oregon. As indicated by the position of the Oregon Farm Bureau, my understanding is that they're not supportive of this, and this suggests to me that most full-time farmers and ranchers are not in support of this bill. And I would equate this removal of an income test for building on farmland to the removal of, say, the Forest Practices Act as it relates to timber production. They both deal with the wise, efficient management of natural resources and the associated long-term benefits. And the intent of either is not to infringe on the rights of the owner, but to ensure a sustainable, viable resource for future generations. And I would ask that you please vote against passage of this bill and allow the next generation to judge that you made the right decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Holcomb. Other questions? Thank you, sir. Tom Malloy and Gibbs and Malloy.
Chair Welsh and members of the committee, I'm Tom Malloy, and this is my wife, Ginger Malloy, and we're owners of Oregon Harvest Vineyard, and we're both very much in favor of Senate Bill 454 passing. It's very critical in our life that it does. While there might be many, many grasslands available for lease, there are no vineyards that are out there to lease. If you want a vineyard, you've got to plant it and take care of it yourself. And we both have something to say, and I'll speak first. My big issue with the EFU zoning laws that were there was that they're being misinterpreted. The EFG zoning laws talk about soil capability classification, which is either low value or high value. And the Department of Land Conservation and Development is ignoring the factors in soil capability classifications, which are nature of soil, type of soil, size of property, location of property, suitability of terrain, and other similar factors. All they're basing this $80,000 figure on is the type of soil. Now, I know that when you call, when the types of soils that are considered in EFU are class 1 through 4, but soil type is not soil capability classification. And I feel that we need to get Senate Bill 454 passed so that there can be a clarification of it. In the soil capability classification, clearly the third one is size of property. Size of property is not being considered at all in this $80,000 rule. They're trying to say that everything that has types, the soil classes 1 through 4 is this high value. Well, soil capability classification determines whether or not it's high value or low value, not soil type. Soil type is only one of the factors in soil capability classification. So clearly they're ignoring five of the factors and calling everything high value. Well, that's just not fair. It's clear from the Department of Land Conservation and Development, from their own figures, they're saying that if you have class 1 soil on dry land, you need 152 acres to be able to make $80,000 a year. If you have class 4 soil, like we do, then you need 378 acres to be able to make the $80,000 a year. It's clear when you read the EFU zoning laws of the past that the $80,000 a year was simply a maximum figure. So if you had 10,000 acres or you had 20,000 acres, no one was going to make you force you to earn more than $80,000 to be able to put your house on it. And clearly, from the zoning laws, if you had less than 10 acres, no one was going to be considering that a viable farm. The real interest was the land that was between 10 and 160 acres. And clearly, when they talk about acreage, it means that the size of a piece of property is a factor in determining whether it's low value or high value. And So if you have class 4 soil, like we do, and you have less than 378 acres, the farm is considered a low-value farm. And there's no possible way that with 34 and a half acres like we do, we can make $80,000 a year no matter what we plant. If we butchered the whole forest and we were to replant it in grapes, it wouldn't earn $80,000 a year. From the figures that the Department of Land Conservation and Development come up with, they expect on our farm that we're supposed to be able to make $7,000 a year, not $80,000 a year. I think it's clear that the Department of Land Conservation and Development is misinterpreting and ignoring the soil capability classifications, and that's why we need this new law, so that they can't discriminate against small farmers. We really do have a dream of being farmers. We don't have another occupation. This is not a hobby farm. This is no game for us. This is our life. When we bought the property and we started planting these grapes, we had the opportunity to put our home in there. And now we're being told that because we didn't inherit the land, we don't have a right to live there. Well, I've managed one of the Oregon State University vineyards, and I know that you have 8 hours after the rain stops before mildew starts multiplying in the tens of thousands. When you're taking care of a vineyard, you got to get on your tractor as soon as the rain stops, and you have 8 hours to take care of the sulfur spraying on the whole vineyard. I don't have time to travel from the city out to the farm so I can get on that tractor. I can't tell when the rain stops if I'm living in the city. You have to be at that farm to be able to take care of it. I should probably let my wife say a few things now.
As you can tell, Tom and I are kind of emotional about this issue. We just found out on Monday that our property had changed zones since we bought it. We had put in for a building permit, and we got a phone call. They asked us, you know, why do you want to do this? Why do you think you should be allowed to have a home on your farm? And we said, well, when we bought the property, that was one of the criteria we were looking at. I think it's important to realize that we have 35 acres, and the front 10 acres was perfect for vineyards. But the middle 15 acres, which is forest, is a completely northern slope. So before we even put in a bid for this property, we realized that that was where our home and our barn, and hopefully, if the business keeps going well, to have a winery there. And, and also that only takes up about an acre for all three of those dwellings. And the rest of that would remain in forest. Now, the front 10 acres is kind of discouraging because after we had the first 10 acres, we wanted to go to the second ones, and we found out that it was really too steep for them to take their machinery on. And when Tom started farming our acreage 10 years ago, he realized that it was too steep for him to take his tractor on. And then we have another problem with the fact that it has Waldo soil, which is a soil classification type. And Waldo soil is a soil that pumps water up and down. We have it in our driveway, and you could put $2,000 worth of rock in a really small space, and the water still squirts up and down. So it's not good for grapes, it's not good for conifers, but it is good for these new hybrid poplar trees. So we feel that by managing the forest, which is a strip down the middle, the hybrid poplars in the front 10 acres, and the vineyard, that we can make it. And we have the availability to earn $27,000 on the grapes. Now, that's really a long ways away from that $80,000 mark. But you can tell I'm in this wheelchair. I didn't start out this way. When we started the farm, I had this head up not surgery, and I was very healthy after having it because I was sick before I started. And when I broke my neck, you know, I had 2 years where I was in bed Tom was coming back and forth from the OSU Vineyard every night, taking care of me. And you have a lot of time to consider what's most important to you. What was most important to us was to be farmers. Tom's a retired building engineer. It didn't hold the appeal. You have to take care of me. I look pretty functional, but I can't even hold more than a cup of water if I reach my arm. If I go to grasp something far away, I drop it. But I do need a lot of care, and we felt that the farming and our unique situation kind of worked together. So we were pretty horrified last week when we found out what was going on. But on the same hand, we were pleased that our government became so accessible to us. We had never realized if we needed help, if we wanted to get to the people that understood what we were going through, that we could. And so I think that it's really terrific that we can do that. And I know we both appreciate the time that you guys are giving on this issue. I'd also like to point out that before 1994, there was you had to put in a plan for your farm. And I don't think anybody who's sincere and who really thinks that they're going to continue being a farmer, not a hobby farmer, not somebody who wants to build a home and, you know, look at the pretty trees, I don't think they'd even give it a second thought to submit one of those. And I suggest that if that hadn't worked previous to 1994, that maybe in the areas of the county assessors, that those plans need to be more actively enforced. Because I do know you don't want to just leave farmland open for tracts of homes, but we told that if you want to farm your land, you should be able to live there. And currently we are living in a tent there so that Tom can farm. It's a very big tent, but it's not very easy to live in. Chairperson Mouse and the rest of the committee, we appreciate your time and hope that our feelings put a little bit more personal spin on it. I listened today, and I know we don't represent what anyone else has. We just represent or even has it. Do you have any questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Susan Lee.
Chair Welch, members of the committee, my name is Susan Lee. I'm employed by Multnomah County. I'm distributing a letter that has been, or a memo that's been prepared by Susan Muir, our principal planner in our land use planning division. Multnomah County is concerned about the negative impacts of Senate Bill 454, primarily concerned about low-density residential sprawl on farmland. The memo that's being distributed includes information that indicates a trend towards increasing homes being placed on farmland in Oregon. On another note, I won't go into all of the details of the memo, but another thing that I wanted to add was sprawl increases your cost of infrastructure. And several of the members of this committee are on the House Revenue Committee, which is currently considering transportation and finance bill. We would raise the concern about this type of development, increasing automobile trips and decreasing the ability of farmers to get their produce to market. And this may also impact our investment decisions on transportation infrastructure at a time when those resources are considerably restrained. So I wanted to provide that information. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Thank you.
Questions from the committee? Cliff Nagy.
Mr. Nagy, that's the testimony with me. I am sure to give a few minutes for the record.
Okay.
If there is no one responsible, we will have a different team.
There will be more. We will come back to 454. We're not doing anything other than hearing today. Okay. Thank you. Marilyn Reese?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Marilyn Reeves. I live in Yamhill County, and I'm here today representing Friends of Yamhill County, an organization that helped found about 4 years ago when citizens became very concerned about issues pertaining to growth. Friends of Yamhill County is here to urge that you vote no on Senate Bill 454. We have, in looking at Yamhill County and in understanding what is there in terms of size of parcels and availability of housing, and I'm not reading my testimony, I'm just going to tell you a story from Yamhill County. It is very clear that we have an abundance of housing as it pertains to the number of forms. Studies have been done which indicate that we've got about 4 houses for every farm. The question then comes as to whether or not we need criteria to be able to determine when we put in more housing. There seems to be a myth about this kind of legislation that it would prevent people from building a house. And yet, in Yamhill County, there are many opportunities for building houses in rural EFU lands. Lot of record is one. Forest template is another. Farm replacements, you can replace a farm dwelling. There are opportunities for farm workers, for relatives. There are hardship dwellings. There are many opportunities for putting new houses on EFU land. I would like to also point out that all of these classifications for dwellings that I brought up, as you well know, have criteria. It is important that we have criteria in order to be able to objectively evaluate when we need more dwellings on these resource lands. The income criteria, $80,000, should it be $150,000, should it be $70,000, it is a criteria that was established. And it is very important that that criteria not be done away with unless there is a substitute for that criteria. I'd like to give you an example of the type of problems we run into when we start opening up our resource lands for building new houses. In 1996, we had a developer who obtained approvals on a less than 10-acre tract. And it was in an EFU 40 zone. Now, he said, of course, that he needed that house because responsible land use necessitates a home. That was on his application. Now, he received permission to build a house on that land. And yet, within a very few months, he applied for another dwelling on a 42-acre tract that was located less than 2 miles away. Now, he stated that he needed to live on that property to manage the farm. Since he already had a building permit on the 10 acres that was just a short distance away, then clearly we wondered how many houses he needed to live in order to manage his farm, particularly since he lived in Tigard and he also owned a house in Portland. Now, the planning director determined that he did not meet the $80,000 income criteria because this was high-value soils, Class 1, Class 2 soils, on the 43-acre parcel. The Board of Commissioners, however, overturned that denial, and Friends of Yamhill County successfully appealed, and we believe that the income test continues to be needed for protection of productive farmland. We urge you to vote no on this bill. This is criteria that has been established and is working. There is no perfect criteria for the establishment of new houses. We believe, though, that this is working, and we believe that we need to prevent further loss of farm and forest land. And I thank you very much for your time.
Questions from the committee?
Thank you.
Larry DeGate?
Chairman Welch and other members, my name is Larry DeBates. I live at 2063 Old Southeast Focal Lane, Amity. I live in a rural area out there. I'm here to testify in opposition to this piece of legislation. I have seen rapid development going on in the last 2 years in the rural area through the lot of record and the four template provisions. Now, I recognize both those were passed by the legislature with the idea of providing limited amount of grandfathering clause to provide a limited amount of dwellings in rural areas to accommodate those people who had also had that piece of land before the legislation, before the thing was restricted. However, what I've seen out there since then is one parcel of land that was divided up through deed switching and everything so that they eventually got 10 approvals for rural dwellings on one, as I saw the legislation, would probably have qualified for one. And then on the next step, it was 13 dwellings that were approved in a forest area of about 60 acres through, again, deed shuffling amongst the family members and applying this out there so that we now have 20-some more residents that have been approved for this area that I live in on an old platted acres subdivision that was put out there in 1908. And I was kind of interested in the discussion earlier related to the bill 2885, where parcelization would probably lead to future demand for rural development. I think it's just an absolute given that once that happens, it has your pressure for more rural developments start. At the same time this building is going on in this area, we also have very big problems with the school district. Amity School, which these areas are affected by, has a very critical budget issue. They are cutting back on a number of programs, getting away from the ag program, cutting back on athletics, and cutting back on a whole number of areas. And at the same time, we're still approving a lot of more rural developments out there, rural homes in rural areas, that's contributing to this factor. I guess what I'm saying is anything that expands opportunity to put more rural home developments out there, I think is ill-advised, and I strongly recommend that you not support 454. Thank you.
Questions from the committee?
Thank you.
Henry Reed.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Henry Reeves, and I too live in rural Amity, east of town. I represent myself only. I urge you to reject Senate Bill 454 that would remove the income test, which presently helps protect high-value farmland. If anything, I believe the $80,000 figure is far too low. Because of rapid population growth in the Willamette Valley, for most of Oregon's finest soils and high-value farmlands are found, our efforts should be directed to strengthening rather than weakening these protective rules. Farming is like any other business, and standards, when evaluating it, must have something that means something to everyone. And one of those measures, of course, is the dollar and what it means in terms of worth, use, and productivity of our land. Another objective measure, of course, is the capability to swear up strong. We had a part of Bud here, and say that too often concern and indeed opposition to the 80,000 rules stems from ignorance and misunderstanding. Many do not understand that the current rule applies only to designated high-value farmland zone exclusive farm use. Others confuse income or gross with profit. The $80,000 applies only to income. On the average, commercial farms in Oregon gross well over $80,000 annually. A farm that produces $80,000 in income provides a profit of only about $12,000 to $14,000. Obviously, far too low to support a two-farm family. I commend your study and the excellent analysis of the $80,000 rule prepared by Mr. Cliff Carnegie, a Benton County farmer. As you've heard, Mr. Carnegie had to leave, but his testimony has been distributed, and I urge you to read it carefully. An observant traveler in the Willamette Valley will quickly realize that we have far more farm dwellings than farms. Most of the excess farm dwellings are inhabited by so-called hobby or part-time farmers who really earn their living elsewhere, or by folks who simply wish to live in the country. A study commissioned by the 1989 legislature concluded that there are about 75% of the so-called farm dwellings approved by local governments were not related to commercial farming operations. I believe that although you will hear of individual exceptions, that this legislation generally is unnecessary. It is a bill that is searching for a problem. Please reject Senate Bill 454 and consider instead how land and exclusive farm use zones can be better protected for the future. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Thank you. We'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 457. We'll open a hearing on Senate Bill 470. Mr. Honeycutt?
Chair Welsh, members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, speaking in support of Senate Bill 470. Senate Bill 470 makes changes to Oregon non-conforming use statute. Essentially what we're doing with 470 is saying that the local government, when determining whether a non-conforming use exists, can require the landowner to show two things. One, that the building was lawfully, or whatever the structure was lawfully sited. And two, that it's been in continuous operation for no more than 20 years. Or they can't make you go back any more than 20 years, in other words. The bill arises from a problem in Multnomah County where a gentleman could show that the buildings were lawfully sited and were in continuous operation from 1957 to 64. And from 1965 to present, but was missing the year 64 to 65. As a result, the county denied him a non-conforming use. Bill passed out of the Senate. I believe either 30-0 or 29-0. There might have been somebody gone. It came out of Senate committee unanimously, and I don't believe there's any opposition. So that's nice. Nice fix.
Quick fix. Yeah. They invited up anybody else to find out here. Thank you.
Good morning, happy
member. Mr. Honeycutt. Any?
One more question.
Close the hearing on Senate Bill 470. Does anybody else want to give a testimony on Senate Bill 470? We will open a work session on Senate Bill 470.
Yes, sir.
Captain Cruz.
I move Senate Bill 470 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Captain Cruz moves Senate Bill 470 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Mr. Chairman, Evelyn.
Since I don't have the record here, does the committee administrator have what the vote was in the Senate?
Mr. Chair, members, I do, if you'll give me 1 second. 29 to iconic she is.
And it's highly controversial, aren't it?
Okay, any opposition?
Well, we'll just have the clerk call the vote, please.
Aye.
Representative Baxter?
Aye. Representative Devlin? Aye. Representative Gianella?
Aye.
Representative Cordy? Aye. Representative Morgan?
Aye.
Representative
Taylor?
Aye.
Representative
Farrell? Aye. Having the required number of votes, I'll call Senate Bill 470, Mr. Farrell, to do pass recommendation. And let's see, who should be the chair? Who would like to carry this bill? Nice one. Stephanie Gianella will be our chair. And we close the work session on Senate Bill 470. We open a work session on House Bill 3259.
Mr. Chair,
that includes the Dash 3 amendment,
House Bill 3259.
That includes the Dash 3 amendment to House Bill 3259. Any further discussion? Any opposition?
Yes.
We have opposition from Representative Taylor.
Am I reading the right bill? I thought we had already...
No, we have not moved on 3259. Okay. We have testimony.
I do have the right bill regarding the public school and working from there. Yeah, I called the measure in.
3, taking appropriate 1, 2, we didn't need 2. Yeah, that was directed to our attorney. Who did that? Okay. We so moved.
Mr. Chair.
President Cruz.
We move House Bill 3259 as amended before to be passed recommendation.
President Cruz moves House Bill 3259 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? President Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, I was asked actually to co-sponsor this bill at the beginning of the session and declined to. I still have some concerns about the bill, but I'm voting it for today and trying to get some changes to it in the Senate.
Okay. Any further discussion? Hearing none, will the clerk please call the roll?
Aye.
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 Representative Gianella? Aye. Representative Corey? Aye. Representative Merkley? No. Representative Morgan? Aye. Representative Taylor? No. Farewell. Aye. And
then
required number of votes. House Bill 3259 has amended. Passes for the due pass recommendation.
Carrier.
Decker.
Decker. Yeah, let's go with the Decker.
Representative Decker. Well, you should get that on that one.
So moved.
You think I am?
We closed the work session on House Bill 3259. We opened the work session on House Bill 3028.
Sure.
President Cruz.
Move the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 3028.
President Cruz moves Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 3028. Any discussion?
Any sure.
Any opposition?
I have to look at it.
Okay. I'll give you a moment. No problem.
And then take your sword.
Oh, that's
the wheelchair one.
I have to close that.
Okay. Perfect. Do you have to close it?
Yeah. And, Deborah
Corey.
Okay.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I'm just getting my folder up.
Jim, if I might comment while he's doing his folder.
How's that 3020?
I think public welfare is mentioned very explicitly, I think, in maybe both in both the Oregon and U.S. Constitution. And I think it's pretty, maybe a broad term, but still a pretty important term.
Is it the Dash 1 or Dash 2 that you're...
Dash 2.
Dash 2. Okay. Yes. We'll have the clerk call roll on this one, please.
On the Dash
2. On the Dash 2.
Aye.
Representative
Atkinson? Aye.
Representative Devlin?
No.
Representative
Gianella?
Warren?
No.
President Merkley?
No.
President Morgan?
Aye.
President Taylor?
No.
Chair Wallace?
Aye. And then the required number of votes, 3-2, and House Bill 3028 passed.
Mr. Chair.
That's
I move House Bill 3028 as amended to the floor to be passed recommendation.
Representative Cruz moves House Bill 3028 as amended to the floor to be passed recommendation. Any further discussion? Hearing none, will the clerk please call the roll?
Cruz?
Aye.
Aye.
Is
No.
Is there Gianella? Aye. Is there Gianella? No. Is there Gianella?
Morgan? Aye. Is there
Taylor?
No. Aye. Having a required number of votes, House Bill 3028 as amended has the close to pass recommendation. Carrier, your estimate
approved. Should be a fun one.
Thank you. Can we close the work session on House Bill 3028? Can we open the work session on House Bill 2885?
Sure. Move the dash to amendments to House Bill 2885.
Question approved and the dash two amendments to House Bill 2885. Further discussion.
Yeah, I'm not even there yet.
Okay. 2885.
Division.
The division of the
member
of
the lot office. Right. And fourth line there. What do you have?
I'm alone.
Any discussion on this? Sure. Will the clerk please call the roll on the dash two, please?
Aye.
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 Is
No.
Is
there Gianella? Aye. Is there Ford? Nope. Is there Berkeley? No. Is there Morgan? Aye. Is there Taylor? No. Fair law. Aye. And
the required
number of votes? Dash 2 minutes, so
House Bill 2085 passed. Sure. President Cruz. I move House Bill 2885 as amended to the floor to be passed recommendation.
President Cruz moves House Bill 2885 as amended to the floor to be passed recommendation. Any further discussion?
Nope.
There you go.
Looks like you're out of order on the road.
What is she drinking?
I think it's Jim. Aye.
Is
it
Atkinson?
Aye.
Is it Devlin?
No.
Is it Gianella?
Aye.
Is it Ford?
Nope.
Is it Berkeley?
No.
Is it Morgan?
Aye.
Is it
Taylor? No. Aye. And the required number of votes, House Bill 2885 has amended passed to close the due pass recommendation. Okay. Carrier. That's a willful carry. Okay, we've got, as I see at this moment, Dave, no further business that I'm going to take. We'll take up the other bill at a later session. So we are adjourned.
I'm not ready to go yet, because I'm waiting upstairs for me.